It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Well, today is my last day filling in as host of the Morning Show, and let's just say it's been quite a time, a really great time. Monday, we welcome Kate Archer Kent as the permanent host. She and WPR's Morning Show team will meet you right here every weekday to talk about things that matter in your life, from politics to the environment, social issues, the arts, the economy, education. The Ideas Network is your bright start Monday through Friday. Right now, though, we're going to have a conversation about Wisconsin's next governor, Democrat Tony Evers. What advice would you have for the incoming governor? What do you want him to do or change on day one? Maybe you want him to keep some policies the same. Give us your take. Do you think Governor Evers should put Democrats and Republicans or people from other parties in his cabinet? Or do you think Republicans lost the governor's race, so they shouldn't be involved in the administration? Either way, give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Steve Walters is senior producer at Wisconsin Eye and the former Madison bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Steve, welcome back to the Morning Show.
John, thanks very much, and congratulations on a wonderful run at WPR, and happy last day of November, my friend.
Yeah, well, last days in a number of ways here. I get to retire twice now, so this is...
You're lucky.
Yeah, well, I have a friend who's retired about four times. That's my actual ultimate goal. Steve, you recently wrote a piece in Urban Milwaukee with some unsolicited advice for Governor-elect Tony Evers, and you start with optics. You say he should enter the Capitol through the main doors. Why is this important?
Well, I go back to... let's just give some context. This month marked my 30th year covering the Capitol, and I go back to the 13 years that I covered Tommy Thompson, and he would enter the Capitol when you could almost hear the trumpets, because Tommy's such a people person, you know, da-da-da-da. And Governor Walker, in the wake of Act 10, he and his family and GOP legislators did face some serious threats. So the governor then was advised by his security detail, hey, let's enter the Capitol in a more low-key way. And Tony Evers is a more of a shy person than Governor Thompson, certainly. So I'm just saying, go back to the idea of, hey, I'm coming to work. And I like it, and on my way into the East Wing office, I'm going to shake a few hands, and whether the visitor is from Shawano or Omaha, that person's going to meet the governor. So that was just the first item in my column. I wrote it because, again, 30 years in the Capitol, and the transition team members are very busy, so they haven't had a chance to return my voicemail or emails. I understand that, and I just offered a bit of, as you said, unsolicited advice.
Well, there's no question that Tommy Thompson is probably one of the best ever at retail politics. I don't think I've ever seen anybody better at it in my time in Wisconsin. He could probably take a few lessons from Tommy about dealing with people and being, you know, upfront and engaging. But that brings up another question, bipartisanship. If we use Tommy Thompson as a previous model, he was also really great at that. How important is bipartisanship going to be to Governor Evers' strategy?
Well, Governor Evers is seeking bipartisanship, and it's going to be crucial if he's going to achieve half of the major things that he would like to achieve. Now, he would like to change some of the 50-plus major changes that the Republicans have enacted over the last 8 years. But in his press release yesterday, Speaker Voss says we're not going backward. So I suggest in the column that you alluded to that Governor-elect Evers choose a Republican cabinet secretary. As you're aware, Representative Travis Tranel is soliciting support for keeping Stephanie Klett at tourism. And I also wonder if Republican Senator Luther Olson wouldn't be interested in being the DPI superintendent, which Governor Evers will name once he takes the oath of office as governor on January 7th. So bipartisanship would go a long way to help Mr. Evers bridge the gap between the incoming Democratic governor and the legislature, which will continue to strongly be in GOP hands.
Yeah, it doesn't look like there's a real welcoming atmosphere in the legislature for some of the things that Governor Evers has proposed, and so he's going to need all the help he can get. You're not the only one pushing for Governor-elect Evers to reach across the aisle. Some people are coming together to campaign not just for Secretary of Tourism Stephanie Klatt, but also someone like Ag Secretary Sheila Harsdorf. What do you think about that?
Well, Sheila is a dairy farmer from western Wisconsin. And I heard her on the radio yesterday. I think it was on WPR talking about the problems, the deep problems faced by our farmers with tariffs and low milk prices. She has been in the legislature for a number of years. She may have cast some votes that would not endear her to the Evers administration, starting with Act 10, things like that. She's a very qualified Secretary of Agriculture. I just don't know if she'd be a fit in the Evers cabinet.
Well, and he has to be a little bit careful here who he invites into the cabinet as well, and, you know, needs to keep have a thought there. I want to invite our listeners to join us again and offer their unsolicited advice for incoming Governor Evers. What do you want him to do when he takes over in January? What advice would you provide? What would you like him to do or change on day one or keep the same? Do you think that he should put Republicans or people from other parties into his cabinet along with some Democrats? Or do you think, hey, you know what? He won the governor's race, so he should be able to just put in whoever he wants. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also email us ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @WPRMornings. We're talking with Steve Walters, senior producer at Wisconsin Eye and the former Madison bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We have invoked Governor Tommy Thompson once already this morning. Steve, you point to a number of actions of former Governor Thompson as a guideline for Governor-elect Evers on a number of occasions. Why is that?
Well, start with the idea that when Governor Thompson took office in January of 1987, He got some advice from his incoming Secretary of Administration, James Clauser. Hey, let's approach Senator Tim Cullen, then the leader of Senate Democrats, about a cabinet job. And Senator Cullen surprised his Senate Democratic team by taking the job of Health and Human Services, and welfare reform got enacted. And I spoke with Senator Cullen last week. He doesn't regret it at all. He is very proud of that. So Tommy had the ability also, when former Democratic senators would not have any luck in their caucus, they would go around and appeal directly to Tommy Thompson. And the best example of that is the late Senator Joe Andrea, who would just go down and see Tommy, pretty much walk in. Probably collected dozens of pens from bill signings. So Tommy, having served 20 years in the assembly, had the ability to work with legislators.
Yeah. And of course, Governor-elect Evers never been in the legislature, so he's got a steep learning curve ahead. Steve Walters stays with us as we continue to accumulate unsolicited advice for Wisconsin's next governor. What's your advice? Let us know at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us @WPRMornings. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Well, since the election, a lot of people have been giving Governor-elect Tony Evers unsolicited advice. Some have even started petitions for him to keep some of Governor Walker's cabinet secretaries. Former Governor Tommy Thompson has weighed in. Now we've got Steve Walters, senior producer at Wisconsin Eye, offering his take on what our next governor needs to do. But we're not happy with just that. We want your advice as well. What advice would you give Governor-elect Tony Evers? What do you want him to do or change on day one? Maybe you want him to keep some things the same. Give us your take. 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Susan is with us in Madison. Susan, good morning. What unsolicited advice do you have for Governor-elect Tony Evers?
I strongly urge Governor Evers to stack his cabinet and all of his appointments with Democrats. He was elected by a Democrat, not Republicans. And he should not make the same type of errors that President Obama did by reaching out to do things to work with a party that does not want to work with him. The majority of voters voted Democrat for Wisconsin representatives and Wisconsin senators, but Democrats in these seats will hold the minority of seats. If that illegal corruption that resulted in this disparity statistically wasn't present to take away the individual equal weight of votes away from Democratic voters because of gerrymandering, the Democrats would maybe hold control of the Wisconsin House and Senate after this election. But that was not possible due to illegal gerrymandering that hasn't been fixed. You do not reward people who cheat and rig the rules to only suit themselves and to screw everybody else in the world.
Okay, Susan, we get it. Susan doesn't want Governor-elect Evers to appoint any Republicans in his cabinet, and she's pretty hot about it. What do you think? Do you think that that's a common sentiment among Democrats in Wisconsin? We're angry, and we're not going to deal with you guys?
Well, it's certainly a sentiment that's out there, but I would just point out that Governor Evers won by a margin of 30,700 votes, and there was about 2.6 million votes cast. So that indicates that he has some need to reach both his base and reach out to some of the 1.29 million voters who voted for Governor Walker. And she talks about cabinet secretaries, and I just want to point out that the five critical cabinet secretaries that I'll be watching is the DOA secretary, the Department of Administration, Secretary of Transportation, Secretary of Corrections, and given the health care debate, where Governor Evers has said his first budget will try to expand Medicaid using additional federal dollars, the insurance commissioner and the Department of Health Services. Those are the five critical, most critical cabinet secretaries that I expect Governor Evers to announce here in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, you point out also that Governor Evers won in 19 Wisconsin counties. Basically, that was where his margin was. The rest of the counties in Wisconsin went the other way. So he's got a what kind of a tight line here, doesn't he?
Yeah, and John, let me just point out. Governor Evers won 19 Wisconsin counties, which is only three counties more than Mary Burke 4 years ago. But I just want to point out the margins that Governor Evers won by in just two counties, in Dane and Milwaukee. And in Dane, he came out of there with a margin, came out of this county with a margin of 151,000 votes over Governor Walker. And in Milwaukee, a margin of 138,000 votes, total of 289,000 votes difference in just two counties. So that's why I also advise Governor Evers in my column giving him unsolicited advice. These other 73 counties, many residents of outstate Wisconsin really don't know you.
Yeah. We had an email from Pete in Reedsburg who sends this. If Governor-elect Evers wants to set a bipartisan tone with his cabinet selections, a good choice would be former Republican State Senator Dale Schultz. He's demonstrated by his votes that he's capable of independent thought, puts principle above party, and knows how state government works both inside and out. What do you think of Dale Schultz in an Evers cabinet?
I've also heard the name of former Senator Schultz. His wife has had some health problems that she's now getting over. And Senator Schultz is another possibility. He wasn't always the most popular in his caucus. He did vote against Act 10. But yes, he's another possibility for Governor Evers to get on the phone and say, Senator, would you consider? And here are the options.
You mentioned the DOA, the Department of Administration. Most citizens don't really know what this department does. What's the DOA responsible for?
Well, the shorthand for the Department of Administration is the Department of All. It's got the budget shop. It signs off on personnel. It negotiates with the tribes on gaming compacts. And it's basically a clearinghouse, even more so after 8 years of the Walker administration. So one of the things Governor Evers has to decide is, am I going to have a strong DOA secretary model like Governor Thompson did with Mr. Clauser, or am I going to have a strong chief of staff model like Governor Doyle did with Susan Crawford and, with Susan Goodwin, and I want to correct that, and Governor Walker largely had a strong chief of staff model. So that's another thing to look for as Governor Evers rolls out his governing team.
Steve Walters is with us. We're offering unsolicited advice to Governor-elect Tony Evers. Want to hear yours as well, 800-642-1234. Darren is with us in Eau Claire. Darren, thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, good morning. I guess my comment was just as to Act 10, as you guys just mentioned. I think that a lot of people who may not have voted for Evers or voted for a Democratic governor probably did so in order to hope that he carries through on Act 10 and reversing that. So I guess that's my comment.
All right, Darren, thanks for that. How likely is it that Governor-elect Evers would be able to reverse Act 10?
John, there are two elements to Act 10, and they have to be considered separately. One of them was the changes to collective bargaining, which basically eviscerated collective bargaining by public employees, with the exception of firefighters and police unions. And the other is making public employees pay more for health care and pensions. Now, Governor Evers can try to go back to restoring some of the collective bargaining rights, but I truly don't think in this environment he's going to tackle the idea of decreasing what public employees pay for health care and pensions. I just don't think that is politically palatable in that capital.
And Steve, when Governor-elect Evers assumes his new role, he has to work, as we've mentioned, with a Republican-controlled legislature in order to do anything, and he needs their buy-in on his proposed budget for the 2019-2021 period. What if Republicans just won't budge on that? What then should he do?
Well, I advise him in the column to consider vetoing the entire budget if it's got nothing in it or almost nothing in it that he wants. The Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald has said correctly that Wisconsin governors have the strongest veto power in the nation. It's not as strong as when Tommy used to do the Vanna White vetoes, which made water run uphill sometimes. But if GOP legislators discard the budget that Governor Evers gives them in late January, probably in early February, and work from the current base budget, and then just mark up the numbers from the current base budget, that is a scenario that Governor Evers may get on his desk a budget with basically nothing or very little that he wants. And that's why I'm wondering if he shouldn't consider what I said in the column was a nuclear option and veto the budget.
Let's take a call here. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, good morning.
Hi. Wisconsin should be a right-to-work state, but the union should only serve those who pay the dues.
All right. Dennis, thanks for that. What advice do you hear there for Tony Evers?
Well, when I interviewed Stephanie Bloomingdale, the new head of Wisconsin AFL-CIO, she made it clear she expects Governor Evers to try to overturn that bill, making Wisconsin that law, making Wisconsin a right-to-work state. I look for him to follow through on that. That's a non-starter in a legislature that dominated by Republicans that passed that right-to-work law. So that's another area of a major potential conflict between the incoming governor and the Republican lawmakers.
We're talking with Steve Walters about what we want the new governor to do when he takes over in January, offering all sorts of unsolicited advice. What would your unsolicited advice be for Governor-elect Tony Evers? What do you want him to change? What do you want him to keep the same? Do you think he should have a mixed cabinet of both Democrats and Republicans, or maybe people from other parties? Or do you think, hey, the Democrats won the governor's race, so they don't owe the Republicans anything? How do you feel about that? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Steve Walters is with us today on the program, and we'll continue to take your unsolicited advice, even though we're going to talk about Christmas trees in just a moment. I'm John Munson. Thanks, Steve, for joining us. It's The Morning Show. Steve Walters is with us. We're giving unsolicited advice to Governor-elect Tony Evers. Steve Walters, senior producer at Wisconsin Eye and former Madison bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, and about to start his 31st year covering the state capitol. Let's take a call here. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, good morning. What's your advice for Governor-elect Evers?
Good morning. I would say maybe two things. Thing one, since voters are supposed to oversee everybody, and the Republicans of the unelected state legislature claim they want to oversee the elected governor, say that in a compromise with them, they agree early to have independent redistricting so the voters can oversee the legislature as the legislature, as its currently unelected form, oversees the governor. Also, implement both civil service reforms and actually test to make sure you have professionals in his appointments, as Walker undid in Walker's attempt to build up a spoils system, which was actually going backwards rather than forwards. And
okay, Nate, we're real short of time here. What about it? Civil service changes? I wonder how that would play in the legislature.
Well, John, civil service changes would reverse the decisions made by the Governor Walker and Republican legislators just a few years ago, point one. Point two, it would not surprise me if Governor Evers, in his budget message, recommended creation of a panel to study a nonpartisan group to draw district lines after the 2020 census. That remains a priority with Democrats.
So if Governor-elect Evers takes your advice and vetoes anything that has very little to do with the budget he wants, and there's no state budget signed into law until September or October next year, what happens? It could go even longer. Look at Illinois.
Well, yeah, but we have a state law. If we don't have a budget by July 1, things continue at the pre-July 1 rate of spending. So our government does not shut down. And it continues. And if we get a budget, if we don't get a budget till September, October, well, there's precedent for that. And things just toddle along in that great building, that Capitol building.
Well, Governor Evers is coming into the governor's office as the former superintendent of Wisconsin's public schools. When it comes to education, how is he going to get his program approved in the legislature?
Well, he has submitted a budget for 2019-21 that calls for an additional $1.4 billion of spending, including $600 million more in special ed. But I just want to point out that there are a lot of demands. The Department of Administration recently projected that the additional tax revenues are going to be $2.2 billion through mid-2021. Well, if Governor Evers wants to spend $1.4 billion of that on K-12 schools, then we have almost $800 million more for our Medicaid program, and the Department of Revenue budget calls for an additional, $231 million for Foxconn if they hit their development and hiring goals. And by the way, Mr. Evers, in the final weeks before the campaign, said, I want to cut taxes on the, quote, middle class, close quote. So there are a lot of demands on that $2.2 billion in additional revenues, sir.
Yeah, it's easy to spend that money multiple times, just like it happens to a lot of us with our own personal budgets. Steve Walters, thanks for hanging around with us this morning. I really appreciate your time.
John, thanks very much, and good luck in retirement, my friend.
Thank you. Steve Walters is senior producer at Wisconsin Eye, former Madison bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. As we get closer to the holidays, many Wisconsinites are putting up their festive decorations. The main event? Well, it's usually a tree. We talk with a reporter about the history of real Christmas trees in Wisconsin and nationally, and we'll also examine how the industry is doing and get tips from a tree producer. Do you put up a Christmas tree? Is it real or artificial? If you do use a real tree, do you cut it down yourself? Where do you go? Is it a family tradition? Tell us all about it. And what tree variety do you like the best? What questions do you have about how the trees are grown and produced in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Rob Schultz is a reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. His recent piece is titled "Real Christmas Trees Are the Feel-Good Story of the Holiday Season." Rob, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning.
And Greg Han is the president of the Wisconsin Christmas Tree Producers Association. He owns and runs Han's Christmas Farm in Oregon, Wisconsin. Greg, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Rob, you recently wrote about the real Christmas tree industry in Wisconsin. How's it doing?
Well, it's faring fairly well. You know, they've taken a hit over the years by the artificial Christmas trees, but as Greg would be the first to tell you, they have fought back with a good marketing campaign of their own and with some very good Christmas trees.
Greg, how is your tree farming doing in terms of that trend?
It's been very good upswing of real trees. We've really grabbed onto the buy local market that's been, you know, trending, what, maybe 8 years now, and then really have tagged into the just a try to market it as a sustainable resource that is grown locally.
And what is it that, Greg, that brings people out to cut their own trees when you could, you know, you simply buy an artificial tree and you just use it every year?
I think it's more of the tradition. Our millennials, as Rob had touched on in his article, the millennials want things to do with their family. They're not a generation where they just sit on their hands. They want to come and bring their kids out. They want to do different experiences. They want to have a family, and I don't know if they're thinking back to their own traditions that their parents brought live trees into the house, but they just want those activities, but then supersized a little bit more. They want a wagon ride. They want different traditions. They want hot cider. They want, more of an agri entertainment atmosphere that's a buzzword around nowadays.
Agri entertainment. Wow, that's a good one. Rob, how did the rise of artificial Christmas trees change the game for tree producers?
Well, they were losing to the ease of the deal for the artificial trees. The artificial trees got better. They became more realistic. And their campaign of, you know, hey, it looks just like a real tree and you can pick it up, but you don't have to go outside and get cold to cut it down, you know, resonated with them. Also, there's less danger. At about the same time, the Fraser Christmas tree was kind of coming onto the scene, first started in the state of North Carolina, and I said in my story, artificial trees, people marketed their trees as the closest thing to a real tree, and the Fraser fir is the closest thing to an artificial tree because it doesn't lose its needles as quickly, and it's safer. It stays green and healthy for a longer time.
Have revenue levels for real tree producers returned to pre-2000 rates?
No, not that. That's going to take a while to for that to recover. They were about one. It dropped about 600,000. Well, I should say it dropped about a million from 1.6 million in 2002 to 600,000 in 2012. And I think the last U.S. Census numbers showed that it was up about to 670,000 in 2014, and it was still supposed to grow. Now, the next numbers that they'll receive on Christmas trees will be coming out sometime in 2019, so we'll know if that number is still going up. But all estimates have shown that the numbers are still trending up.
Greg, Rob mentions the Fraser fir as the superstar of Christmas tree varieties, but Wisconsin also a great place to produce balsams, Scotch pines. Tell us about those.
Fraser fir is a great tree. It's still an exotic considered in Wisconsin. We don't get the rainfall like the Carolinas. So the balsam is kind of coming back strong. Again, the one thing that the artificial or fake tree industry doesn't have is the real smell. If they could figure out how to bottle the smell of a real tree, I think we'd be in trouble. But, you know, people want that smell. They want to come downstairs after putting up the tree the next morning and smell the fragrance. So the balsam fir really has the best smell, and both of the pines still do. The Scotch pine and the white pine were hugely popular in the 70s. Better needle retention. Any pine will give you a better needle retention than any fir at all. So I think when we moved into the balsam fir more, we lost some of that market just because of needle retention compared to what the Scotch pine are. But the balsam is coming back very strong just for that fragrance.
Greg, what do you say to people who say that cutting down a perfectly healthy tree every year is bad for the environment?
It's actually the same as cutting a pumpkin or a watermelon. We're growing them as a crop. It just happens to be a 7 to 10 year rotation. A lot of the Christmas tree fields that are planted used to be ag crops where they'd be rotated every year. When you put it into Christmas trees, you get a 7 year rotation. With that 7 year rotation, we've provided a whole lot of habitat for nature. We've provided ground cover. Some of those fields aren't completely empty. We have deer, you know, birds, turkeys, all the way through the whole circle of life, Lion King stuff that we're providing all the way to the insects and planting flowers. I know monarch migration's a big thing, providing that kind of atmosphere too.
Okay. We'll continue our discussion about Christmas trees in Wisconsin, the real kind. Wisconsin State Journal reporter Rob Schultz and Greg Hahn, president of the Wisconsin Christmas Tree Producers Association. Stay with us. You could maybe share your story about going out and getting a Christmas tree. I know my kids and I used to go out and get one every year, and it was always a lot of fun to go out in the woods at my mom and dad's house and pick out the tree on Thanksgiving and then go back 2 weeks later and cut it down. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of WPR. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're talking about Christmas trees this morning. What tree variety do you think is the best for the holiday season? Or do you even put up a Christmas tree? 800-642-1234. We're talking with Wisconsin State General Reporter Rob Schultz and Greg Hahn, President of the Wisconsin Christmas Tree Producers Association. Greg, you mentioned agritainment earlier. I'd like to come back to that just for a moment. Tree farms sell more than trees these days. They sell an experience. For example, what else do you offer at Hahn's Christmas Farm, and how is that similar to what other farms across the state are doing?
Yeah, we've really tapped in as an industry to try to bring in that younger generation of young families. So at my farm, we do a wagon ride. A lot of farms have photo frames where you can take a picture, tag it, you know, go into social media. Santa and Mrs. Claus. We have a large gift shop or even Christmas shop. It's not just gifts. So it's just, I've heard of sleigh rides going back to horses at some of the farms, horses and sleigh rides, petting zoos. We have, you know, it's a chance to have pet a reindeer. Some of the local farms here in the area have reindeer and throughout the state. So it's just anything that is more than just run and get a Christmas tree.
And where can people go to find out what's happening in their part of the state?
Well, our association has a nice tagline. It's a real tree for me. You can just type that in and at any web bar and just type in real tree for me. We have a nice map that you can click on your region and find either retail lots with a real tree or choose and cut, either one.
Rob, does Wisconsin export real Christmas trees? And if so, how many and where do they go?
I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but the biggest percentage of their business is wholesale, and I know that the North Carolina has dominated the Fraser fir industry for years, but they've got a shortage of Fraser firs right now because of that cycle. They're just not at the cuttable size yet. So the national wholesalers are coming to Wisconsin. The last 2 years, they've basically sold out of all the trees that they've been able to cut down. So that's a big part of the business. It goes across the country.
Greg,
however, you know, there's always going to be a real tree for anybody that wants it. There's, you know, there is a buzz about a shortage sometimes in the media, but anybody who needs or wants a real tree here in Wisconsin, we're not exporting them all out. There are plenty of trees for this Christmas holiday and many more to come.
Right. I mean, that was a perception last year. Just because one state might be short of trees, it doesn't mean that the country is short of trees.
Greg, what tips do you have for folks who are looking to get a real tree this year? What should they know before they go?
If they're cutting one, you have fresh cut it completely. If you're going to a lot or even buying a pre-cut tree at some farms, make sure that you cut at least an inch off. That sap will actually kind of cauterize the end of the trunk. If you can do a fresh cut at least an inch or 2 inches up right before you put it in the tree stand with a nice rough saw. Sometimes people use a finishing carpenter saw, and that'll even do more damage. Again, it heats up as you're trying to go through and cauterizes those cells. So a nice a loose cut with a chainsaw or old bow saw actually works better before you put it in water. And then keep a lot of water in the stand. The tree could drink up to a gallon, gallon and a half of water. Save your aspirin for your headache after, you know, Christmas Eve, and save your soda for mixing cocktails, all of that. Nothing does as well as real water. There's a few tree preservatives that are on the market that do well, but basically, keep it watered.
Water's good, and we had an email that reminds us to only harvest trees from tree farms or lands where they know the landowner. That's pretty important. That's a biggie, and I'm sure you would both recommend that as well.
Yes, as somebody who lives out in the country and has spruce trees who's seen them get cut down, I'd prefer them to go to Christmas tree farms.
Okay. Greg Hahn, president of the Wisconsin Tree Producers Association, owns and runs Hahn's Christmas Farm in Oregon, Wisconsin. Thank you, Greg.
Thank
for
you.
For being here. Rob Schultz, reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He wrote a recent piece, Real Christmas Trees, the feel-good story of the holiday season. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCullum with a story about a bionic donkey.
There's a miniature donkey in Fond du Lac who underwent a groundbreaking operation this year. Ferguson was the first large animal to receive a prosthetic leg from the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. WPR's Jenny Peek went to check in on Ferguson and his caretaker to see how he's recovering.
Come on, Fergie. Come on. Come on, love.
Gets a little noisy around here.
Noise aside, Angela Langoski of Holy Land Donkey Haven has been in the business of rescuing donkeys since 2011. To date, she's given shelter to about 90 donkeys, young and old, standard-sized, and miniature. 2 years ago, a miniature donkey named Ferguson came into her care. His front foot was severely deformed, so Langoski enlisted the help of the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine.
His feet were horrible. You know, I knew it came to a point to where it was going to have to be amputated. They took some more x-rays. They agreed that there was nothing more we could do. We lucked out with Ferguson. The university was awesome with us. He spent 2 months there. They only charged us half of what they normally charge because they were really giving us a break. Plus, his operation was such a groundbreaking operation that they wanted to see the outcome. We have, like you say, the right people that wanted to help. And you see him walking around, and he's even gotten to the point to where he runs. It's just when you see something like that, it's like, you know what? It's worth it. I call it being selfish myself, the satisfaction that I get, the feeling I get, but it's worth it.
Since his operation, Langoski has noticed a major change in Ferguson's attitude. She says now that he's not in pain, he's gotten braver and spends more time socializing with the other donkeys at Holy Land, like his best friend Grayson.
But since he's no longer in pain, he could get around, he could make his own decisions, especially with going in and out. Yeah, even when we first put Grayson in with him, he let Grayson know he was in charge. This was his area. You go by my rules. And Grayson is so sweet and accommodating. There was no issues, you know. It was like, hey, whatever you say, man, I'm with it, you know, that type of thing. But I do notice a big, big difference. They even noticed it at the university. When we brought him back last week, they couldn't believe the whole change in his demeanor.
All right, are you done? Success stories like Ferguson's are one of the many things that keep Langoski going. Over the years, she's also gotten used to taking orders from her donkeys.
They're smart. They're smarter than we are. You know, really, seriously. And that's bad when your animals are smarter than you. But I accept it. You know, what the heck? You know, I mean, really, who's in charge, me or them? I'm cleaning up after them, and I'm feeding them. So I think they're in charge, you know. But that's okay. I don't mind having them for my boss.
It's that spirit that always keeps the doors of Holy Land open.
We don't turn any donkey away. Like I say, this is what we're here for. They eat before I eat. They go to the vet before I go to the doctor. Because that's what we're here for. We're here to take care of them.
That story about Ferguson the donkey comes from Jenny Peek. She's a digital news editor at Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of WPR and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.